5 in Canada, but it's still -7 or -8 in Helsinki at the moment. And last weekend I was out skiing, so you know, things can only get better. Spring is coming at some point, maybe. Looked like it was going to be spring at the weekend. Anyway, yes, I'm David Weir. I am at the University of Helsinki, at least for another year, at which point I'll move to Nottingham to take up in the ERF. Yeah, I'm going to tell you about gravitational waves from the sound of a first-order phase transition. So this is it's an exciting time to be changing slides. It's not happy. There we go. Okay. It's an exciting time to be changing slides or studying gravitational waves because we've now seen them at LIGO. And there are many potential sources, both astrophysical and cosmological, that we can think of. I always think about there being kind of three broad classes of detectors. Of course, we have the pulsar timing arrays, which are kind of the longest wavelength thing we can think of, which kind of actually are sensitive to a particular type of source rather than just primordial background. And that they are operated about nanohertz scale based on the way in which you take, I don't know if people are familiar with how the pulsar timing arrays work, but you basically look at a large number of very stable pulsars, not the kind of naughty pulsars which have misbehave or have quakes or whatever on them, but really, really stable millisecond pulsars. You build up a model of them, and they are basically like atomic clocks. And you observe them regularly, you observe about 100 or so of them regularly. And then if you notice that there is a discrepancy between your timing model and what you expect it to be, how you expect it to be pulsing, then you kind of infer that there's been a change in the proper length between Earth and the pulsar. And if you then correlate that with the results of other pulsars, then you can see whether or not a gravitational wave has passed through the Earth. So they give you because of the distances and timescales involved for these millisecond pulsars, that gives you something about nanohertz scale, which is why, for example, the North American pulsar timing array collaboration is called NanoGrav, Nanohertz Gravitational Wave Observatory. If you're thinking about like a stochastic background there, that would be kind of the temperature, the time in the thermal history of the universe at which that would have produced a first order phase transition is around the QCD scale. And we know that the QCD phase transition was, in the absence of magnetic fields, wasn't first order. So that's not a place where we can expect to see something. But then kind of around the millihertz scale, we have the space-based detectors like LISA, and they, for example, LISA will launch, I'll come back to it at the moment, but it'll launch in 10 to 15 years from now, and that, because of the arm length, it's sensitive to around the millihertz scale. And there we have, there's a plethora of astrophysical sources. I mean, in fact, maybe too many, one might argue. There's many, many white dwarf binaries within the Milky Way, for example, and that almost makes it a little bit harder to see for example, sources, stochastic backgrounds from, for example, what I'm going to tell you about today. But there's also other things. There's what are so-called large extreme mass spatial inspirals, which are where very small compact objects spiral into supermassive black holes. They produce a significant source there. And also the black hole binary mergers and other events that you see at LIGO. You can kind of see their early history already in LISA. If you follow them through, you'll see them a few months or years before they actually inspiral and are seen in the LIGO wave band. And I think we all know kind of about these Earth-based detectors like LIGO and Virgo. Although, of course, if I was recommending that you do make a trip to see one, I would suggest you go to Tuscany because it's a lot nicer than going to Hanford or where it's like nuclear waste all around you and stuff. But Virgo is a lot nicer, even if it's a bit smaller. So those are the sources, but I want to concentrate on LISA and start with a little bit about LISA Pathfinder. And this is a picture from the PRL, which they had out nearly a year and a half ago now, which is the first their main paper about the results from LISA Pathfinder, which of course took them long enough to get up there, but when it got up there, it did really well. Basically, acceleration half acceleration power spectrum. So this is kind of an expression of how in free fall the test masses in spacecraft are at any given length scale. That's how I like to think about it anyway. The really cool thing here is that it was expected or required to kind of perform as well as this gray shaded region. And in order for it to be kind of ready to go for LISA, then it would be down here, this lower curve here, and it really pretty much hit the spot there. The reason why it rises on the high frequency is basically short noise from the interferometer. That's why it doesn't behave itself up there. Is everything okay?
Not to read you.
Oh. You can actually look at the slides online if you want. I can give you a link to the URL to view the talk online if that helps. If you've got laptops and stuff, I can give you a link to the URL later anyway. Sometimes I give the talk from the web anyway. Anyway, it doesn't matter. If you want to see them, I can give you the URL. This is web-based, the presentation. Anyway, so you know, it's very, very impressive and very, very promising and gives us great hope that Lisa Pathfinder will do very well. And then this, just 2 months ago or so, they actually released an even better set of results where this curve here is again LISA requirements. Blue curve is what you saw on the previous plot, the noise, the kind of the deviation from kind of the amount of kind of detector noise and how not in freefall the test masses were versus what they then got after analyzing data more carefully, which is this nice lovely red curve down here now. So it gives someone a lot of hope that LISA will fly and it will do very well, and all the things we can test, including like putting an optical bench into a spacecraft, blasting it into space to a Lagrange point, and making sure the test masses are in free fall, that whole thing works incredibly well, and we have got a great deal of optimism that can work. Is there a question?
So is the difference between those two curves just a better analysis?
Yeah. As far as I know. I'm not on LISA Pathfinder, but as far as I know, yeah. So what's next? LISA's next. This is an awful artist's impression, which I always complain about whenever I have the opportunity, because you can't see the lasers. The spacecraft won't quite look as cute as that does. Pretty sure about that. And I don't know what the blue thing is, but don't mind about the awful artist's impression. LISA's going to be absolutely huge. As I was saying, alluding to earlier, it's going to have about 2.5 million kilometer separation, which is a good deal larger than the Earth-Moon distance, for example. And it's going to be three satellites which are station-kept at the L2 Lagrange point in this huge triangular configuration. Really, really, a really big project. And it's probably the largest kind of constellation of satellites that we've ever kept in position relative to each other, which I think is mind-boggling if you don't even imagine what else is going on here. It will be the third large-scale mission. It'll launch in or indeed before 2034. It's fully funded. And we're approaching kind of with the next couple of years the freezing of the specification. NASA are on board. There will be joining all of the working groups for LISA. There will be a person coming from North America to join each of the four working groups involved in the project to be kind of the point of contact for North American science on the project. And it was already so we the this document, this mission profile, mission proposal was submitted a year ago. As the L3 mission, it was the only candidate because these things are always done as a setup, and it was adopted by ESA as the official L3 mission in the middle of 2017. And what's in the middle of it is this. The LISA proposal has lots of, the meat of LISA will be astrophysical observations, which is not surprising because there's so much interesting astrophysics to have there, and it kind of is in some sense almost in the way of the cosmological sources, but of course they can be teased apart from each other. But one of the scientific investigations is to set limits on the cosmological gravitational wave background. And the kind of numero uno first option for what you might see there is stochastic background from first order phase transition. That's kind of the most likely thing you would see there. The other options or other things you might see, for example, are the gravitational waves from a network of cosmic strings, but that's more likely to be probed to kind of good degree of accuracy by pulsar timing arrays than by LISA, or for example inflation. But then even for like a well kind of tweaked gut scale inflation model, you're kind of at your energy density gravitational waves is going to be a bit below what LISA can see. So these are kind of things you're not going to necessarily easily see at LISA. So really your last great hope for a cosmological stochastic gravitational wave background, at least is going to be first order phase transition. So I'm afraid you're stuck with me and my collaborators for a while. How does the electroweak phase transition work? Well, again, in case you aren't don't know. It's the process by which the Higgs boson kind of turned on and went from the false vacuum to the true vacuum. And I'm going to go into more detail about this over the next few slides and kind of talk about how we know this is the case. But in the standard model, minimal standard model, without any extra stuff, it's a crossover. There's no non-equilibrium physics. It just remains in equilibrium as we go from the false vacuum to the true vacuum and just gently flops over. But of course, there are many extensions of the standard model where you add extra fields, or Higgs is a composite particle, or you know, whatever else you want to do. Or in the NMSSM, for example, which are not ruled out and which experience first order phase transitions, and that in itself are very, that's very attractive, of course, both for principal baryogenesis would be one reason why that might be nice. Another reason would be, you know, you get a observable signal of gravitational waves, for example. So there's many nice reasons to think that you get a first order phase transition at the electroweak scale. And this was something which we, you know, was kind of almost expected to be ruled out in the 1990s, certainly for the minimal standard model. I want to explain how they did it because it's very interesting and it kind of sets gives you an idea of the kind of program that we're working on now to explore this for extensions of the standard model. So the minimal standard model phase diagram looks a bit like this. This is the x-axis here is the Higgs mass, and the y-axis is the temperature of the universe. And there is essentially a first order critical line up to about 75 GeV. This is for nothing else beyond the minimal standard model. And this was the exact form of this phase diagram was kind of difficult to determine perturbatively. So what was done in the mid-1990s was a kind of multi-stage program of first the dimensionally reducing the four-dimensional field theory to a three-dimensional field theory, and then studying that non-perturbatively because it's easier to study the three-dimensional field theory without fermions than the 4D one. But the long distance physics is correct, so you know that you're okay with that. I'm going to come back to all this stuff over time. But the kind of key point is that, you know, by that stage, by 1997 or so, it was pretty clear that not only, so we knew that this was the end point here was an Ising universality class critical point, and we knew that certainly for the Higgs mass that we now ended up seeing at the LHC, that the Higgs was going to be the standard model was going to be a crossover phase transition. So you're not going to get any first order phase transition, which means, for example, you knew you weren't going to get baryogenesis in the standard model, minimal standard model, and you wouldn't see, for example, gravitational waves from a scenario like that. So there's many reasons why it would not, you know, it wasn't going to work. This was beautiful work, and it was done kind of independently by at least three different groups using various different non-perturbative techniques, of which I think the most successful, however, was this dimensional reduction from 3D to 2D. So again, just to go over what I mean by that, I mean that, you know, you have a thermal field theory of this system. And because you have such high temperature, the kind of temperature direction can be thrown away in some sense, and you integrate out the non-zero Matsubara modes, and then you're left with a much simpler field theory to study than you originally had, and you discard kind of quite naturally in this the fermions and various other fields like that don't really matter to this the heavy long distance physics when you study it non-perturbatively on the lattice. And the end result is a theory which is a lot simpler and which is very safe to study on the lattice and which non-perturbatively gives you very good results and is very predictive and very, very, very nice. So that was what was done in the 1990s for the minimal standard model and then the MSSM at some point as well. And if I can change the slide, this is how you use it to study it. So you take the Higgs phase diagram, and this dimensional reduction, which you have essentially a 3D field theory of just the SU2 gauge field and the Higgs doublet of that gauge field, you have two dimensions parameters. You have basically the quadratic coupling m squared over g to the fourth. That's dimensions ratio there for the 3D theory, and the quartic coupling, 3D quartic coupling divided by g squared, basically in 3D again. And this gives you a two-dimensional parameter space for this very simple minimal standard model in 3D. And the dimensional reduction takes you from the 4D field theory, thermal field theory, to this 3D field theory. And then you have essentially a critical line, which is about y equals zero, more or less approximated about one part per thousand or so. And then the But the thing which you kind of need to know, which you need to do the simulations for, is to work out exactly where the endpoint is in terms of x. It turns out it's about 0.11 or so. And then this thing here maps onto that thing like that. But this is not a one-to-one and onto mapping. You can take other field theories which, for which the dimensional reduction can be done, and of which other field content can be integrated out, and map it onto the same 3D model. So if you have an extra heavy scalar field, for example, then you can integrate that out, put it in here, and in the mapping, the dimensional reduction mapping from that theory's phase diagram in 3+1 dimensions or 4 dimensions thermally to the 3D theory is different. And so this endpoint here corresponds to different Higgs mass in the original 4D thermal field theory. And that's the kind of the recycling procedure which we are using in some recent papers. It's not a new idea. It was actually originally done by Klein and Kainalainen in a paper on the MSSM in about 1997. They didn't do it. They only did it for kind of a restricted part of the MSSM. The thing we're trying to do here is recycle it more generally for several more minimal models, like I'll come back to the ones I'm thinking of in a moment, but like the singlet model and Turing Stubble model and things like that. But it's not a new idea, I want to emphasize. It's not something we came up with. But you can map multiple models with sufficiently heavy field content, additional field content, onto the same 3D theory, and it works. There's nothing sneaky there. You can do that. That's okay. Yeah, how's the time? Good. I'm gonna skip over that. Yeah, so standard model is a crossover. As I said, there's no real departure from thermal equilibrium, which means that you don't get gravitational waves, which is neither here nor there. It's just an observation rather than something you want to see. But it also means you, of course, don't get baryogenesis. And of course, that in itself is not a problem, because there's many alternative scenarios for baryogenesis, ranging from the niche to the popular. And I've chosen the popular one and the niche one here. So the natural kind of alternative way of getting a baryon symmetry of the universe is leptogenesis. And that's has very widespread adoption, is very popular. But then, of course, there's kind of more niche things, like the fact that you take advantage of the spinodal decomposition in this crossover, and then you get cold electroweak baryogenesis and things like that. So there's no reason to think that you need to have this. But if we were to assume that we do want to have a mainstream standard electroweak phase transition, then the kind of options that I worked on recently, which this kind of recycling recipe that I kind of motivated this talk with, we've applied this in recent months to the Higgs singlet model, which again is the only kind of reason motivation for that would be from our point of view is to see a gravitational wave power spectrum there, and that's difficult to rule out with colliders. And then the triplet model, which is actually, from the point of view of the procedure, very remarkably similar to doing the singlet model, even though it has also a gauge coupling to the additional triplet field. And then, of course, there's a region where that could even be a cold dark matter candidate if you believe Michael Ramsey-Musoff. But in between is the Turing Stubble model, which is quite constrained and it has lots of parameters which you need to scan over. But our results for that actually quite strongly support the perturbative results of people like Margaret Muller-Leitner in kind of understanding where the signal of the transition is in terms of the pseudoscalar mass and the Higgs mass. That's quite promising and reason to be optimistic that what we're doing is useful and important and corroborates 4D and 3D perturbative calculations as well. It's very, very useful. But all of these are kind of models in which you would see, for example, if these were realized in nature, a region of parameter space, which is not ruled out by current observations, for which the phase transition would be first order. So now, having spent 20-ish minutes kind of motivating what I'm going to look at, I'll tell you a bit about the things that one actually does with these simulations, and kind of my main thing. So what happens in a first order thermal phase transition, with the thermal being the operative word here? You nucleate bubbles. Of course, and these bubbles are expanding in a plasma of all the light standard model particles that are sloshing around. They're all 106 and a bit of their degrees of freedom. And as they expand, they create reaction fronts in front or behind the bubbles. We'll come back to that in a moment. And in turn, they make shock waves, potentially, depending on how strong they are. The bubbles and the shocks collide, which is a violent process, and that both sources of gravitational waves immediately and then also for a while afterwards, continuous source gravitational waves. Mostly from the sound waves that are left behind, these acoustic waves, perturbations of energy density which travel through the plasma, the speed of sound of the plasma. And then after a while, after the time scale, like the standard time scale for shock formation, you start to get shocks forming there as well. And then a turbulence cascade starts to form. Whether that starts before or after the expansion of the universe dilutes this source altogether and turns this off, that's something which kind of needs to be seen and studied more carefully. And I'll explain why that is again in a little while. But this is kind of the general t-shirt of how it happens. And here's another pretty picture of it because I never get tired of showing you pretty pictures. So how do we get to that effective model with pretty pictures? Well, you start at the bottom. And that's with this kind of equation of schematic equation of motion for how the wall, the bubble wall, the scalar field, which models the bubble wall, interacts with the other particles in the system. And basically, you have the equation of motion for the field with the effective potential there. And then you look at the deviation from the equilibrium distribution of the various particle species that are sloshing around in the plasma, which get kind of get pushed out of equilibrium by the passage of the wall. And that's, you know, that's basic, the basic story there. And it's not very, you couldn't really just do this in a non-equilibrium lattice simulation for a whole box, certainly with all the gauge fields and stuff around there. So one tries to simplify it a bit. The point of view of the kind of most, the kind of a simpler way of putting it is like this. You have the force outwards from the latent heat, which is liberated as a result of the thermal phase transition pushing the wall outward, which is opposed by the friction of which is resulting from the particles being pushed out of equilibrium. And the end result is, hopefully, that you reach terminal velocity, v wall, at which the wall continues to propagate outwards. It was previously thought that there was a region of parameter space for certain transitions where the outward force due to latent heat would always be greater than the frictional force, and therefore the wall would accelerate to highly ultra-relativistic speeds for these thermal phase transitions. But it was pointed out in a paper last year by Guy Moore and Dietrich Boudicker that actually relies on a kind of underestimation of the importance of the heavy gauge bosons that are sloshing around in this plasma. So if you treat them carefully and on the right, you know, you zoom their contribution in this, you know, approximation to be large enough, then they actually, generally speaking, mean that you always reach a terminal velocity for the wall. So you can this V wall is always that V wall is always it can be supersonic. It can be a substantial fraction of speed of light, but the gamma factor is never going to be much, much bigger than one. So it's not going to be huge as a rule, and kind of as a rule of thumb, and without any firm justification of that, I would say that, you know, it's never going to be, you know, 0.99 or so. It's going to be approximately the speed of sound within an order of magnitude, basically. At least if you're going to see it. But then if you then climb this kind of ladder of ignorance a bit further, so you start with the fields and the particles, and you go to kind of a Boltzmann equation type way of thinking about the way the distribution functions. You can then go further than that to kind of a fluid ansatz, where rather than having all the particles as particles themselves, you instead think of a very simple fluid analogy for that. And you get down to a very simple model of a field coupled to a relativistic ideal fluid, which is the kind of the thing which I end up simulating in order to see what's going on in these things. And I'll come back to that in a little while. The question? Yeah. Okay, cool. So that's the kind of the ladder of ignorance and which was climbed in the 1990s, including by various people, like, trying to understand what was going on with these bubble wall and coming up with an effective description of it, which was then adopted later by people trying to simulate it, like me. But then I want to talk a bit about the kind of the three phases here, which actually source gravitational waves, which I alluded to again in the previous slide, where I kind of introduced the different stages of a thermal phase transition, and kind of talk about what things source metric perturbations as you have one of these phase transitions. So bubbles nucleate and expand, and you have reaction fronts and or shocks forming. And then as these reaction fronts collide, or the bubbles themselves, that's kind of why we call that, or I think we call it also in various papers, the so-called envelope phase, where the kind of the surfaces of the bubbles, the envelopes of the bubbles themselves interact. And that's short-lived. I mean, it's it, takes as long as the phase transition takes to complete. It's not very, very long, and is not the most efficient source of gravitational waves that there is. And after the phase transition is completed, you have the you have some sound wave perturbations in the fluid, in the plasma of standard model particles, and that continues to source gravitational waves until turbulence or the shocks form and turbulent cascade develops or expansion dampens you. And that's how you then call it the acoustic phase. And then again, if you have a turbulent phase before expansion, then that would be, depending on the strength of the magnetic fields at the time of the transition, could or could not, may or may not be MHD turbulence. That's the kind of turbulent phase. And these three things happen one after the other.
Has anyone calculated the size of the strain that could come out of this?
Well, I mean, as a...
Lagrange 10 to the power minus 21. So you have to know whether you can reach a strain level that can be detected by these.
That's a good point. What generally people work with is the energy density in gravitational waves as a fraction of the total energy density of the universe. And that, then you can convert that to the strain which you would see at LISA. I can show you what that looks like in a little while. But the sensitivity curves which we use and to calculate the signal-to-noise ratios that we see, they are in terms of the energy density in gravitational waves. That's kind of what the cosmologists see.
One thing. See something.
You can see something. For some models, you can see something. You can certainly rule models out. If you've not by that stage ruled out some models, you can rule things out, which is nice. If you don't believe me, we can talk about it later. But there are models which you can rule out, and I'll show you in a while. So step one is the envelope phase, which I actually for a long time was seen as the way of doing things. It turns out it's kind of an oversimplification in some sense, but it assumes that the walls are thin and that the bubbles are hollow. So basically, all the stress energy is scooped up and put on a delta function thick shell of stuff on the wall. And these delta function thick shells of stuff overlap. You count up how much overlap there is, how much solid angles kind of intersected already. And that tells you, in some direct way, the amount of gravitational waves you've sourced. So when the phase transition completes, the game is over. But this assumption that the walls are thin is not accurate. The assumption that all the stress energy, all the latent heat gets swept up with a certain degree of efficiency, dumped on the wall in this delta function thick shell, just then creates gravitational waves is also an oversimplification. But it gives the advantage and the reason why it was so popular for so long is that it gives you a simple answer, which is always nice. The simple answer gives you is that there is one lens scale, which is the size of the bubbles at the time of transition. Which is a substantial fraction of the Hubble scale, so that's where you get your peak and your scale set in the power spectrum, and then you have a wave number cubed power law at long wavelengths, which is basically due to the fact that there's nothing longer than the largest, no structure on the scale is longer than the largest Hubble size, and then this omega to minus one, the wave number to minus one on shorter length scales on higher frequencies, which is just due to this delta function approximation. It's intrinsic to the approximations that you've made. So it's a very simple power spectrum. It's very attractive if you just want to do something. And this used to be applied to the whole thing. So it used to be applied to all the stages of this transition. They assumed that was the only thing that occurred, basically, except for maybe a turbulent phase later on. But now I think the only times in which it would be used would be for kind of rather contrived situations where for example, maybe you have thick wall bubbles, but without much other particle content. So therefore, the walls do interact and kind of quite quickly disappear, or where you have the walls move ultra relativistically as well. But generally speaking, if you have substantial coupling to the rest of the particle content of the universe, then the most interesting thing is the presence of this plasma, in which reaction fronts and shock waves form. And therefore, this would only in that case be used for the field gradient energy of the scalar field bubble wall, which initially collides, which would be very much a subdominant source of gravitational waves at the time of transition. So this is it's nice and it's cool and it taught us a lot about how these things are done. And it's still interesting, for example, if you have a vacuum or near vacuum transition. I think probably with thick walls, it is probably quite predictive for that kind of scenario. But it's for thermal phase transitions at the electroweak scale, it's really not what you're looking for. But again, the number of parameters you have is quite small. And in fact, it's basically just the vacuum energy fraction, so how much energy is in latent heat at the time of transition, how fast the bubble walls move, how much of the vacuum energy ends up into the gradients of the bubble walls, which is depends on basically whether the bubble walls accelerate to ultra-relativistic speeds or if they reach a terminal velocity. And then the rate of the transition, so basically how fast the transition completes relative to a Hubble rate. And that's, those numbers basically all it goes into creating gravitational wave power spectrum ansatz with a broken power law form for this, which looks like that. The reason why I bring this in now is that the red curve here is a lattice simulation I did, and it's a comparison to what you get from the envelope approximation, which is the black circles, to which the ansatz is the blue dotted line. And the reason why I show this is that it shows you the difficult, the kind of the attractiveness of doing these approximations. If I do a lattice simulation of bubbles expanding numerically, simulate that in a box, I have a largest lens scale which I can probe, which is the size of the box. And then I have to, if this is a scalar field theory which I'm studying, there's inevitably a wall width which sets kind of the smallest lens scale I can look at, which is down here. And of course, on the length scale of, if I'm looking at scalar field walls expanding, bubble colliding, then this kind of gives you an exponential fall off around the time when that starts to look sick compared to the size of the when the wall starts to look thick on the length scale of the gravitational waves being produced. In between, you get a couple of decades of envelope behavior, which is this wave number to minus one. And the peak is set by the size of the bubbles, which here is a substantial fraction of the box size. So I bring this up now to show you that all the difficulties, or kind of give you a toy example of the difficulties which are faced when you do these non-equilibrium field theory simulations of phase transitions in the early universe. You have to fit in, you know, into the box, between the box size and the scalar wall width. You have to fit in the size of the box itself and various other issues form. And it gets even harder when we try and do something which involves also the fluid, which we'll come back to in the next section. So the next step is to revisit this coupled field and fluid system, which was actually originally developed. I mean, this was originally done by people like Centrella and Kurkisuonio to look at old inflation in the mid-1980s. But then they realized in the early 1990s people were interested in these thermal phase transitions for cosmology. And so they used this model to study the expansion and behavior of bubbles in QCD and thermal other, well, at that point, QCD phase transition, but also electroweak phase transition and things like that. And they did it. They used them exactly this model I motivated from this ladder of ignorance earlier, that you have field and fluid bits, and the overall system is conserved. And then you get some sort of friction parameter which takes energy out of the field. So the latent heat is in the effective potential for the field. That drives the field out, the bubble walls outwards. There's a friction term which converts gradients of the field into kinetic energy of the plasma, but overall is conserved. And the form of this, with this phi squared over temperature thing here, that is kind of derivable from the microphysics. So if you hold your nose long enough to go from like some actual field theory through to the form of this field fluid system, then you end up with something which looks roughly like this phi squared over t coming out here, in addition to these kind of Lorentz covariant bits as well, dimensionless damping parameter. But making all these connections kind of in one go is too much, really. So we just work with a toy potential here, which gives you the right latent heat for a given scenario. And you get your phase transition duration from the number of bubbles you have. The amount of latent heat in your toy potential tells you what the phase transition strength was. And then you tune your dimensionless parameter to give you a wall velocity that kind of works, what you gives you what you want to have. And then if you do this in spherical coordinates, you get two broad classes of solution. One is a detonation, where the bubble wall is faster than the speed of sound. And I'm going to run this simulation, this movie, a few times to give you an idea of what's going on here. The top one here is the scalar field, normalized scalar field. The bottom is the radial outward fluid velocity in the frame of the wall. And the x-axis here is the radius of the bubble divided by time. So this reaches a scaling profile. This gets sharper because the bubble wall, the scalar wall width is microscopic and fixed. This reaches a scaling profile because it's an ideal fluid, and away from the scalar wall, there are no lens scales at all. So it's just a wedge of fluid, which just sees no lens scales and gets very, very big. I'll run it again and tell you some more stuff. If I can remember which way. Hello. Here we are. Yes. Here we go. So, radius over time. Bubble wall expands. This is approaching a terminal velocity here, the scale field. This is a rarefaction wave, so it's a detonation. So it's the thing is moving faster than the speed of sound, and there's a rarefaction wave of kinetic energy behind it. Between the speed of sound and the ideal fluid, which is 1 over root 3, about here, and the wall velocity, which in this case is about 0.7, 0.68 or so. And if you let this run for long enough, you would end up with a nice wedge here, but because it's a finite duration simulation, you still don't have quite the scaling profile formed here. It takes a while for that to develop. We can also solve from the kind of steady state equations for this. You could equally well solve for the form of this wedge. You don't need to do a non-equilibrium simulation to see that at all. If you have a larger damping term, then you end up with a deflagration, which looks kind of like a snowplow. So it's a deflagration, again, is a term borrowed from combustion physics, because the you know, it's much same if you had some kind of burning gas or other flammable fluid or gaseous object, and it starts burning, then and the reaction front expands slower than the speed of sound, and looks something like this. I think of it as like a snowplow picking up the particles in the plasma in front of the wall. It looks like this. You get a kind of wedge-shaped thing like this. This is, generally speaking, would be the scenario where the wall moves slower than the speed of sound is more likely to occur, I think. It's easier to get because they're more likely to be a large friction term. And also, for example, if you're thinking about a model where baryogenesis is possible or where you want to get baryogenesis, then with some very unusual exceptions where you have symmetry restoration, you need to have deflagration in order for the electric baryogenesis process to occur in front of the wall. In order to have the generation of a baryon symmetry, you need to have this plasma, and you have to have the particles bouncing off the wall and still having some time before the wall sweeps them up and the washout occurs. So that's what deflagration looks like. I'm going to skip over this and go back to telling you a bit more about the dynamic range issues that you experience. So often in these simulations of the early universe or in the approximations, because they are difficult and because there are many lens scales, you end up just trying to handle one lens scale really well. And the envelope approximation, I would say, as a semi-numerical technique, is really good at that. It's very good at, it throws away everything you need other than the size of the bubbles, and that works really well for what it does, but it doesn't, as I've tried to point out from these movies of the walls, you have these thick, almost bubble-size wedges of plasma, which take up a lot of the, you know, they can be a substantial fraction of the size of the bubbles, and you know, a large substantial fraction of the energy content of the transition ends up in those shells of stuff. So that ignores all that stuff; it's all thrown away. So in the real world, you'll have the horizon size, and the bubble radius will be a substantial fraction of the horizon size, and then these shells of plasma will be a substantial fraction of that. Then you have many, many orders of magnitude down to the actual wall thickness, which will be on the Higgs mass scale or whatever, mass scale of the particle fields which are driving the transition. But if you're going to do this on the computer, then you want to simulate these things at equilibrium, then you need to fit all these things inside your box and then make sure that they're well resolved by lattice spacing. And that becomes a bit annoying and means that you are having to make a lot of compromises. And so the simulations that I'm going to show you the results of, or which inform the results I'm showing you today, they are based on about 1 million CPUR simulation per go. I did about 16 or 17 of those to get the results in these recent papers. So that's about as big as you can get, and it kind of, you know, getting more dynamic range than that would involve, you know, going, say, if you want to double the size of these lattices, that's going to be, you know, about 10 million CPUR simulation at current time. So that's, I think we've kind of gone as far as we can go with these simulations, which is a bit, you know, we've done what we can. So here is an example movie of one of these simulations. This is what was in the background of my title slide. I'll play this one a couple of times as well. So this is for a detonation. So these rings are, this is a slice through a 3D simulation box. It's not the entire box. This is a, was actually, it was done for a public outreach talk, and I did this as a 4K Ultra HD movie, which I had to send to a special effects company, which took a couple of days of uploading to their server. There's a visualization of one of the simulations I've been talking about. This the hotter colors are areas of higher kinetic fluid kinetic energy density. And this is a detonation, so the hottest is on the outside of the rings. And as I said, the reason why things appear to enter the slice at late times is because you are nucleating bubbles in the entire 3D box, and then the shells enter the box at late times if they've been nucleated far from the plane of this visualization. And so at early time, I'll run it again in a moment. We'll run it one more time now. There we go.
So do you assume thermal initial conditions for the field and the nucleation events are happening self consistently, or do you just seed them in?
I just put them in. That's maybe too. I mean, to get the actual thermal nucleation event. I mean, it's a totally classical, totally classical deterministic non-equilibrium field theory simulation with the plasma coupled in. So you can't get nucleation to happen. You just have to put it in by hand. Sorry. But the other stupid thing I did here, which I, in retrospect, if I was going to show this movie to people and try and impress them, is I made the wall velocity very close to the speed of sound here. So when the bubbles collide, you don't actually see the sound waves speed up or slow down. It actually looks very disappointingly similar to the behavior before the collision. If you're wondering why the collided walls look like they don't look like they accelerate or decelerate, that's why. It's because it's very that was a mistake to do that. But anyway,
what is that, but is that energy density or what is the?
That's plasma kinetic energy density. Yeah. Okay. So,
why are the new bubbles within the old bubbles?
As I said, so they're nucleated out of the plane. This is a slice through a 3D simulation, and the bubbles enter the slice at late times. One more time. It's nice, and I like to show nice things. So I'm a nice guy. So if you look at this ring here, for example, one of the other ones, you'll see that this kind of wedge structure appears. Maybe it's good here. So the largest kinetic energy density here is on the inside of the rings. This has this. If you imagine like a slice through here, that has that wedge profile I was telling you about, where the most of the kinetic energy density is peaked close to the edge, because this is a detonation. And then after the walls collide, then the energy density starts to decrease because there's no longer the latent heat feeding it. So this is quite nice. It is pretty. But then the thing which kind of you need to look at is the, let me just move the cursor out of the way. Oops. Cursor out of the way. For example, the velocity power spectra. Now, because we have a lovely HD projector, this doesn't actually look quite as terrible as it sometimes does. So on the x-axis here is the wave number times the bubble radius at time of transition, time of collision. And the y-axis is the logarithmic velocity power spectrum. And you get kind of a wave number to the fifth at long wavelengths. And then you get a power law of minus one-ish, minus two-ish, something like that, at high wave numbers. And the peak is not at k times r star is 1. It's that k times r star is about 10, because it's set by these fluid wedge, the thickness of these sound shells, these fluid wedges, rather than the bubble radius. So it's still a large fraction of the Hubble radius, but it's not set by the bubble radius. It's set by the sound shell thickness. And that's very interesting and useful, because it means that if we were able to see the wave number which the gravitational wave power spectrum peaks, that would tell us a bit about the size of the bubbles and their behavior and properties at the time of transition. This is what the gravitational wave power spectra look like for this. The shear stress for a fluid is, you know, basically is like the enthalpy times the fluid velocity in two directions, and so therefore convolving that with itself gets you the gravitational wave power spectrum, or at least the power radiated in gravitational waves. But here again, we have the wave number times the bubble radius. And on the y-axis here, we have the gravitational wave energy density per logarithmic frequency interval times divided by the time duration of the simulation divided by the radius of the bubbles. And the reason why it's important, for example, to emphasize that it's divided out by time is that this is approaching a stationary, these approaching stationary curves. The amount of, we are not including the effect of turbulence here because the simulation is too small, it's too short-lived, and so therefore this is purely these sound waves propagating in an ideal fluid. And that is a source which is stationary of gravitational waves and continues to source until we run out of time with the simulation. So these different curves all sit on top of each other when you divide out the time. And then this red curve here is the ansatz for the broken power law from one of these phase transitions which we used in the LISA Cosmology Working Group paper on this about 2 years ago. One of the key ideas behind doing these larger simulations was to falsify or verify that ansatz worked when you had slightly better simulations, so about an order of magnitude more CPU time available to do them. And then you have a nice power law here, which is wave number to minus 3 or thereabouts. For fast deflagration, it seems to be more complicated, but for detonation, it's a nice clean minus 3 there. So this source, this sound wave source is on basically until turbulent behavior or expansion attenuated. Then you have turbulence. And as I said, I really can't say anything about turbulence because of the size of the transition. The simulations are short. If you look at, for example, if you separate out the transverse and longitudinal parts of the power spectrum, the longitudinal part is way, way, way bigger on all length scales for which you can resolve the power correctly. The transverse fluid velocity power spectrum is several orders of magnitude down. And then you need basically to run the simulation for the shock formation time scale, which is basically the length scale, largest length scale system, which is the size of the bubbles, divided by the kind of fluid velocity, which the average fluid velocity we call u bar f here. And that's kind of sets you, gives you an idea of a time scale, which is about an order of magnitude longer than these simulations, which is why you probably have to do something separate. You have to do a separate simulation or use existing results, whether they are theoretical or experimental, sort of numerical, to see what's happening there. But whatever you do, you end up with a expression for the energy density and gravitational waves from turbulence, and you add these three things together in whatever size they need to be. Now, to put it together, the first time we did this for a variety of models was in this paper, which was the LISA Cosmology Working Group paper on this from about 2.5 years ago now. We're updating this at the moment. So if you have a model that you'd like to see voted off, or if you have a model you want to have kept in this time, you can let us know, and we'll add it to this. We're going to do another survey of various areas, particle physics models which can produce the first order phase transition at the electroweak scale, which is observable by LISA, and we can update that. There are these three sources which I've gone through, and we know roughly their dependence on nucleation temperature, phase transition strength, the wall velocity, and the inverse phase transition duration. And there's a nice paper by José Ramones, Minoza, Thomas Constantin, José Minot, and Géraldine Savant, where they kind of go through the exact way in which you do these calculations step by step, and it's a really lovely paper. I strongly recommend you read it if you're at all interested in these things. And then if you know these for your given model, which you can derive, determine them, then you can predict the signal. Now I'm showing this here because it's from this working group paper. And the first thing to point out is that the envelope phase is thin wall, the initial kind of scalar field wall bubble collisions are so unimportant, they're not even visible here. They're a couple of orders of magnitude below this. And they'll be, the peak is way off. So the main thing which sources gravitation waves is, in this case, if we assume turbulence, which in this case we assume to be due to magnetohydrodynamics, so there's some magnetic field which seeded that, and sound waves, which I've been telling you about before. This is quite a finely tuned transition, which is why you get such a huge power spectrum, gravitation wave power spectrum. And here is partial answer to your question about what energy density and gravitational waves you can get down to with LISA. This was 2.5 years ago before LISA kind of got properly funded and when it was kind of still e-LISA. So if E-Lisa had been all we were going to get, then for power law, stochastic gravitation wave backgrounds, once one had removed the confusion noise due to white dwarf binaries, the expected sensitivity curve would have been this green curve here, up here. Whereas these are various intermediate configurations, the other ones here. Whereas the actual Lisa sensitivity curve is for stochastic gravitational wave backgrounds from cosmology is more or less what this red curve was in this original paper here, which is nice. This is a very finely tuned scenario, and if you do a mental integrate convolution of the black curve here with the red curve here, the signal to noise ratio that you would get for this is very large. I mean, if this very nicely contrived scenario with a huge amount of energy and gravitational waves and a very fast wall were actually to happen, then you would for sure see it at LISA, for example. Life is not necessarily that kind, but that's how it is.
So sorry, I missed it. Were you saying you don't have to worry about confusion noise with astrophysical binaries, some background of them?
You have to take it into account. Of course, the thing is that the confusion noise is mostly from sources within the Milky Way. And therefore, you can look at the time variation of the signal to deconvolve the stochastic gravitational wave background from cosmological sources from that, which is due to white dwarf binaries, for example. So you can separate them out. It's not a problem to do that. Of course, whether then after that the signal noise ratio you see from a cosmological source is large enough you actually to say anything useful is questionable. I mean, that's something that you can say yes or no, might be. But that depends on the model. And it depends on what's producing the gravitational waves. But it's certainly possible to separate them. That's not a problem. It's not that you can't say which one it's coming from. I mean, if you talk to people like Antoine Petitot, they'll tell you very confidently that they think it's possible for LISA to deconvolve the two. We had other plots like this. So this is a dead laser. On the x-axis here, we have the phase transition strength alpha. On the y-axis here, we have the nucleation rate relative to the Hubble rate, which tells you the basically the size of the bubbles. And so we had various plots like this in this old working group paper, and we'll update these in this upcoming paper in a few months. We just chose some benchmark points for various models. This particular slice was had some kind of dark matter shadow phase transition models. A couple of phase transitions where the physics was modeled by a dimension six operator in the standard model, and then some points where the physics came from the Turek sublet model. And I think these points may actually already been ruled out by more recent updates to the collider constraints on the Turek sublet model. So they won't, for example, as an example of something which needs to be updated for the next paper on this. We'll need to work on these Turek sublet model points and come up with ones which are still viable, for example. But as a rule, if you have a model, you can compute these four or so parameters either perturbatively, as you would, or as I'm trying to motivate by using this dimension reduction and taking advantage of existing non-perturbative results, or by doing new non-perturbative simulations, come up with these four parameters. And then give you something like this plot to put things on. And then I would argue that the state of the art is something like this. This is just a plot I kind of threw together for a fellowship panel, and it seemed to convince them. So maybe it'll convince you as well. The x-axis here is u bar f. So it's an average fluid velocity, but it kind of tells you the kinetic energy system. And the y-axis is the Hubble the bubble radius relative to the horizon size, and that's kind of the bubble radius. And on this we have signal to noise ratio curves for LISA. So this is assuming that all the gravitational waves are sourced by the sound wave contribution rather than any contribution from turbulence or from these initial bubble collisions which we saw were subdominant anyway. And if that's the case, then you can work out the how much kinetic energy ends up in the plasma from the first principles, then you have for a given value of the u bar f and for r star, how large the SNR is for what signal noise ratio LISA would see for it. And to give you an example of what this looks like for some of these benchmark points from this LISA working group paper, these four A, B, C, D blue blobs here are the benchmark points for Higgs portal model or singlet scalar field extension standard model. And they were given in this LISA working group paper as points A, B, C, and D. And so here, for example, when this, if one just takes this as a given, then point B is kind of the first one you could hope to see, whereas C and D are kind of, I mean, they're kind of, if they happen, then you would see them. That's the good news. The bad news is that the gray shaded region is the region for which the timescale on which shocks form is longer than time it takes for the source to be attenuated. Therefore, you can completely trust me. Where it's not shaded in gray is where the formation of shocks and the development of turbulence will be important. And that will tend to drive pull the gravitational wave power spectrum from these scenarios downwards and to the UV. So that would almost certainly mean that these signal to noise ratio curves get dragged up to the right a bit when one takes that into account more carefully. And that's something which one still needs to do. So these diagonal curves here tell you the time on which shocks form, basically. So this is basically the y-axis divided by the x-axis, gives you a time scale. And so therefore everything shaded gray doesn't happen. Or happens too late for it to matter. Below that, it starts to happen before the source turns off, and you're not necessarily in trouble, but you're living in interesting times, and you need to take that into account. So there's more to do, and one needs to think more carefully still about how these sources work together. Basically, that's important to properly appreciate. Now I want to propose you a pipeline. I was a Marie Curie fellow in Norway, in Stavanger, which is the oil capital of Norway. And therefore oil pipelines and leaks therefrom were certainly an issue which was prominent in the people's minds there. But I have a slightly cleaner pipeline, which is just pure particle physics and cosmology and doesn't involve any pollution of the Earth. And that would be to properly understand what happens in one of these scenarios. And the way you would do it, if you want to do it kind of, I think kind of in the gold-plated fancy pants way, but you take your model, which would presumably be an extension of the standard model, so some singlet extended standard model or a two-x doublet model or something more fancy, composite model, whatever. I would then recommend you study the dimensionally reduced model, which you can get. It may be that the additional particle content is heavy, and therefore it maps, like I've been telling you, onto this well-studied 3D model that has been looked at extensively in 1990s, which you understand everything already. It might be that the additional field content is necessary to drive the transition or isn't so heavy that it's kind of at a heavy scale and therefore can't be integrated out. So then you have to keep that as well. That will then probably involve you doing new simulations to understand the phase diagram of the theory non-perturbatively, or at the very least, you'll need to do a 3D perturbative analysis to make sure that you understand what's going on there. Then you probably want to calculate the nucleation rate. If there is a tree-level barrier in your new model, then you're probably okay with doing a perturbative calculation of nucleation rate as is done usually. But if that isn't the case, as for example in the standard model, then you'll probably need to revisit the non-perturbative calculations of the nucleation rate, which were done. I think the only people who've ever done that are Guy Moore and Kari-Rum Mokainen in the 1990s, and they did it for just one point in the minimal standard model, which needs to be fixed. I think that's something which we should revisit. And then you calculate the wall velocities, again, from first principles, if you can. And then if you have all these things, you put them together, you have these four parameters that I've been telling you about, the phase transition strength and the nucleation, well, the phase transition temperature from calculating the phase diagram. Nucleation rate, either from your perturbative studies or from doing a non-perturbative study if you're keen and you have a few years to spare. And then hopefully you also know the wall velocities either from first principles or from some nice, nice arguments. And from that you get the gravitational wave power spectrum. And if the model you are you're thinking of supports CP violation and your wall velocity is subsonic, then you can also think about cooking up this Phelan rate for this, which again, is a these nucleation rate calculations are actually very similar to this non-perturbative scalar rate calculations. So if you can do one, you can do the other one, albeit you have to do a bit more mangling with winding numbers, but it's not something, it's not too difficult to do if you know what you're doing. So far, however, you wouldn't want to put oil down this pipeline because it's a very leaky pipeline. Even for the standard model, there's lots of things missing, like the nucleation rate is only known for one parameter choice. So I think we need to, this is the plan, and we need to get these things all tightened up a lot before we can say with confidence what's going on here. But it's exciting and has many interesting kind of offshoots.
So how crucial is this that the extra fields are scalars?
That depends on how heavy they are. So I mean, it's
like heavy. I mean, does it work for fermions too? This dimensional regression.
Well, it should do. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it depends on it really depends on the details of the model. But I mean, I've only really thought in detail about the scalars. But yeah, in principle, it can work for any extended field theory beyond standard model. Yeah. So with that, I've run out of time. So I put up these things, so you can have some, if you want to off the shelf question to ask me while I stand here, then here are some things you could ask me about. But thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak here.
Would you solve the Wakefield approximation in general relativity? Find that the source of gravitational waves is a quaternion radiation.
Yeah.
So source. So you need bodies accelerating to produce gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
For example, two black holes or two neutron stars spiraling. So I don't understand for your phase transition or your bubbles, how do they produce a quaternion radiation?
When two bubbles collide, two bubbles is a bad example, but we have multiple bubbles colliding, the system is no longer spherically symmetric, and you have expanding time-varying sources of energy density which are not spherically symmetric, and that sources gravitational waves. If you have two bubbles, then that's actually a bit difficult because then it's that's a very special space-time which doesn't have. They're not orbiting, but they are time-varying.
Oh.
They're not black holes, no, they are.
No, I know.
Yeah.
Two bodies orbiting.
No, because you have the system is not spherically symmetric, and when because of that deviation in spherical symmetry, because you have more stress energy on one side of the thing than the other, you get quadrupole moment from that.
You get the quadrupole radiation formula.
You do, yeah. In fact, it turns out. So yeah, I mean, for example, if you want to kind of see. This is beyond kind of you get more than it's not just the quadrupole. You get a Grignard-Vanishing quadrupole moment, but you get higher order moments as well. Yeah, but for example, in fact, you can see if you look at the paper, the original paper on these envelope approximations, there's a very nice discussion of how you get non-vanishing quadrupole moment for this. That was a paper by Kamienkowski, Kozlowski, and Turner, for example, where they discuss this in quite a lot of detail and kind of compare what you see from a full field theory simulation. Versus this envelope approximation versus just assuming that all it produces is the quadrupole moment. And the quadrupole moment itself is non-zero, but actually it underestimates how much gravitational waves you get from this.
One last question.
Sure.
So the laser would have a certain strain that you can measure gravitational waves.
Yeah.
So it's not obvious that you can reach a strain models. I mean, you're putting in numbers.
No, you're right. It's difficult. It's going to be very, very, very difficult. And yeah, I'm not telling you that this is like you're going to see something at LISA for sure. And the models which you can see with a degree of confidence and with a relatively high signal-to-noise ratio at LISA are finely tuned. And of course, they depend on physics beyond the standard model, of which we have no evidence at the moment. And so you're right to be skeptical. You're very right to be skeptical, and I understand that.
So just to follow up on John's question, so the physics you actually put in here, you're solving the fluid and the scalar field equations on a FRWB background, and then you're taking
Minkowski.
Minkowski.
Yeah.
I mean, does that matter when the bubbles are the size of the bubble radius?
No, because if the duration of the transition were so long that being in FRW mattered, then you'd be in trouble already. So I mean, the duration of the transition needs to be much shorter than, you know, it needs to happen in a very short time scale so the expansion doesn't matter. So that's not the problem.
You have things that are the size of the bubble radius, doesn't the expansion matter to them?
You have the expansion will attenuate the source, after a Hubble time or so. But from the point of view of like generating the source, it doesn't matter because it also the peak scale, like the redshifts at the same rate as the expansion. So yeah.
So you're also running for times that are much shorter than the Hubble time?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then you're taking that stress energy tensor just using the linear field equations to calculate the gravitational wave.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then redshifting it with the standard time temperature relation. Yeah.
So my question was, let's say you do detect the stochastic gravitational wave background. Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of smoking gun to tell you it's actually that as opposed to any other source? Or?
Good question. I mean, of course, so the first question, going back to what you were asking before, is about confusion noise and white dwarf binaries. So the first thing you check is where the spatial distribution and things like that. There's a clear scale with these, right? So there's a scale which, because of the fact we're thinking about the electroweak scale, the peak will be around the millihertz scale because it's given by the size of the bubbles at the time of the transition. If you see a peak there, which kind of depends on you, the way in which you would kind of see one of these sources at least is you would tell them the spectral shape you're looking for, and they would kind of fit to that in the data and tell you whether it's ruled in or ruled out. If you were able to resolve a peak, that would tell you that this is what you've seen because, if you had one of these other sources which kind of they think they might see inflation or cosmic strings, they will essentially have no scale which is visible within LISA, LISA waveband. I can't see how it would be anything else but that. I mean, if you see one of these distinctive power laws. One upon wave number or wave number to -3 or something like that. And that also is kind of telltale that this is what's happening, that it's some sort of physics on the bubble size. But also by then, it could equally well be by the time we're in the position to see this, whether it's at LISA or maybe at a future experiment like DeSaigo or BBO. I mean, it could even be that by that stage you have hints of some particles at a certain mass, which then give you kind of a guidance as to which scenario you're looking at. And then we don't know what we're going to be able to say about the actual particle physics content, beyond the standard model at that stage. So it could be that we have some input from that as well.
So do you have a feeling for how loud the signal has to be to not only sort of the integrated signal across the LISA band have some statistical significance, but to actually see the peak and be able to differentiate that from a power law or something like that?
So can you ask a question again?
Oh, I was just wondering if you had a feeling for how loud the signal would be so not only does sort of the background when you integrate it across the entire LISA band have some statistical significance, but you could actually tell that it was different from something that didn't peak within that band or
I don't know. I have to think about that. But thanks for the question.
Any other questions?
Well, thank you very much.